All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Should be a good one for you today, if everything goes well. Eric Margolyes is going to be on the show, talk about India and Pakistan, well, first and foremost, and then I could ask him about a lot of other things, too, here, depending on how much time he's got. Probably not much, because he's in France right now. So I imagine, you know, he's probably busy. But anyway, we got him for at least half an hour. We're going to learn all about India and Pakistan. Did you see this morning on CNN? The president of Pakistan traveled to India for the inauguration of the new president. Well, so we're going to learn all about him and all about the BJP and all about Indian politics and all about, of course, the Kashmir conflict and the importance of this. I mean, who knows exactly what will happen. But, seems like a positive sign, right? For the Pakistani president to show up at the inauguration of the new Indian president? I'm impressed. I'm hopeful. We'll see what Eric Margolyes has to say about that. He's the author of the book on the Kashmir conflict, the division between India and Pakistan, War at the Top of the World. Anyway, so we'll talk with him all about what's going on there. And then Phil Giraldi's going to be here because he wrote this thing for uns.com, baiting dragons, bears, and lions. Are the Persians the lions? I guess I'm ignorant. But yeah, dragons and bears, I know them. That means China and Russia. Not that it's very likely, but still the two countries America is most likely to get into a nuclear war with. Yes, let's pick a fight with them. That was one of my bumper stickers for 2008. Pick a fight with Russia. John McCain, 2008. Don't you want to die in a hydrogen bomb war? Yeah, let's see, wherever there's a conflict with them, let's see where we can make it worse, maybe. Now the Chinese, they don't have enough to destroy all of humanity forever. They've only got about a dozen or maybe two dozen nukes ready to go. But they're H-bombs. And that's sure enough to deter the hell out of me. How about you? You want to lose San Diego and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Vancouver, Washington? Or I'd probably nuke Whidbey Island there. The Air Force up there. Washington State. How about Denver, Houston, Austin, New York? Are you willing to lose one American city at all in a war with China over anything? Me neither! Which is why I wish that the U.S. government would cease to exist, because all they do, rather than protect national security, is threaten it. So anyway, here we go, uns.com. Baiting dragons, bears, and lions. Phil Giraldi fed up with American foreign policy still. good thing that. So that'll be coming up on the show as well. Now, let me go ahead and start with this because, hey, why not start with this? I suck. Poor Miles is mad at me, dude. Miles, you know I ain't no good at doing stuff, man. Cut me some slack. What do I know about doing stuff right? Nothing. Nothing at all. I only do stuff, you know, three quarters right at best. Come on. So stop pretending like you expect perfection. Because you know better. All right, well, Obama wants 10,000 troops in Afghanistan. Well, the headline is 9,800. Oh, got me on a technicality there. Plus 200 mercs. You know, I don't know. Obama wants, no, probably plus thousands of mercs. Obama wants 9,800 troops in Afghanistan after 2014. I have a question. Why is this news? We knew that all along. They've been saying all along. Oh, I know what it is. It leaked that they were going to make an official statement like this. I don't know. It sort of looks like they're making an official statement because it leaked. But Why did it leak a thing that everybody already knows already? Do I not have a whole rant here on Friday or sometime very recent? Was it yesterday? I had my whole thing about, man, does it make any sense to leave 10,000 troops in Afghanistan? Isn't that sort of kind of at least possibly setting yourself up for a roof of Saigon type sacking of Saigon sort of catastrophe? Is that enough soldiers to complete any particular mission, including force protection for their own selves? And then, of course, in come the drones and whatever, but air power isn't everything. What if the Taliban all come at you one at a time just with undercover attacks inside Kabul and nearby the bases, but refuse to just march as an army on Kabul in a way that would be easy to wipe them out there in the desert? But what if they decide they're going to all, you know, just walk one at a time into Kabul, and then they're all going to try to take on what's left of the American presence there all on one day in a big Tet Offensive type thing from inside? What's to stop that? 10,000 soldiers? Is that really enough? You can't lose a war and give up a war and stay forever at the same time. Does anybody think that they have anything like a Korean-style armistice here where, hey, at least the South thinks they need you? Their government does need you. Needs you to keep propping them up and to protect them from their enemies. But, you know, can at least do the controlling of their own people themselves, right? Does that look like what we have in Afghanistan right now? They're going to go on the Korea model, which they got 35,000 troops there. But anyway, they're going to keep 10,000 troops. You know what I wonder? I wonder if Barack Obama isn't sort of kind of doing the right thing here and actually doesn't mean it. And actually, just like with Iraq, doesn't try that hard to get the immunity deal. However, there's a lot more elite consensus about staying in Afghanistan than there is about Iraq. Than there was about Iraq back when he was running for office and that kind of thing. It says here in USA Today, with 10,000 troops, the U.S. military can support about 6 bases, along with their Afghan counterparts. Oh, that's quoting Michael O'Hanlon, chief Democrat who lied us into war with Iraq. The worst warmonger Democrat anybody can find. Although he smartened up on Iran after a while, I guess, so he's not the worst person in the world, but still. There you go. He invokes Germany, Britain, Korea, and Japan. Where's the virtue in declaring now that the follow-on mission will only last 2 years, O'Hanlon says. It seems to me that keeping the American people safe should be the fundamental emphasis. Not being able to say that we've totally departed, right, because keeping the American people safe and keeping American soldiers in Afghanistan are the same thing, and nobody needs to explain why. You know, to me, it sounds like you might as well be invoking the, third phase of Jupiter in your astrological chart, and, you know, as mocked and paraphrased in The Onion. Show me the cause and effect between protecting my life and killing Afghans. You can't. It's just a stupid lie. Give me a break. The virtue of Afghanistan is that it is the absolute ass end of the world and nobody can get anywhere from there. It is exile. The only reason that it was good for a base for bin Laden was because Bill Clinton was too much of a coward to send anything but Tomahawk missiles to kill the enemy that he had created by murdering 1 million Iraqis, including 500,000 of them children, from bases in Saudi Arabia. But he could have done. America could still reach there to get him. But bin Laden's been dead now since 2011, and he's been out of Afghanistan since 2001. This whole thing is a farce. Unless you sell bombs to the U.S. government for a living. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This here's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, we'll have Eric Margulies on to talk about India, Pakistan, and God knows what else. Got plenty going on. And Phil Giraldi will be on to talk about America's relationship with Russia, China, and Iran. And I guarantee you he'll have some good stuff to say for you there. Just a couple of housekeeping things here real quick before I get back to the wars. First of all, I need advertisers. Hey, do you own a business? Maybe you want to advertise on the show? My email address is Scott Horton. No, it's not. It's scott@scotthorton.org. And I work cheap. Maybe we can make some money. Probably worth a try. scott@scotthorton.org. Let me advertise for your business. Also, if you're just sitting on a pile of money and you feel like donating some of it, I'll take that too. scotthorton.org/donate. And to all the people who do donate regularly and irregularly and however you do and in any amount, a million thank yous because, it makes the show possible. It helps, it more than helps, you know, bridge the gaps between the advertising dollars. It's a big part of what makes the show possible is your support. So I'm not going to sit here and NPR you to death over it or anything, but I love you and I appreciate it and thank you. Okay, good. So, and then now my next thing I want to say is, man, isn't the guy that does the top of the hour news great? FPP Radio News. I don't know what FPP stands for yet. I may have been told already, but I forgot. But I don't care because, anyway, the guy's name is Daryl, and Ian Freeman told me that that's his guy that helps him run LRN there. And he's the guy that does the FPP Radio News. And I say, yes, and more, and hooray. And isn't that the greatest top-of-the-hour news you ever heard? On, you know, AM-style format network radio? Awesome. So, thanks, Daryl. Keep it up, man. I like having you for the top-of-the-hour news, dude. You're doing great. All right, and then one more thing is, oh yeah, this Sunday I am going back to hosting Liberty Chat at libertychat.com, and that's, at least it started out as an attempt to kind of bridge libertarian with the right a little bit, and I'm happy to stick with that theme as much as I can, but anyway, I think it's become a bit broader than that, but it's about coalition building, and here's the other cool thing, is I'm coming on right before Adam Kokesh. So hopefully I'll get to, get a few of his listeners tuning in early for his show. We'll, participate in my show. And then I'll get to hand it off to him every Sunday night. That'll be great. Good old Adam Kokesh. So that'll be at libertychat.com on Sunday nights now. And the way it works there at Liberty Chat is basically I'm hopefully on your behalf. Hopefully there to keep my mouth shut and just facilitate the chat room questions, basically. Like, if I can tell what they're trying to say, or I think I know what they're trying to say, but they're not saying it very well, sort of maybe paraphrase it and say, well, what about this question here? Something like that. Or if nobody's got a good one, make a question up on my own to help keep the conversation moving forward. But otherwise, it's mostly to facilitate your interaction with the guests. And I think we're going to focus mostly... Well, I think I would like to focus mostly on bringing libertarians on to make righter-than-thou type arguments to right-wingers. Any real conservative must oppose the entire state, root and branch, or else what are you, some kind of a commie? You know, stuff like that. See if I can get Tom Woods on. That's Liberty Chat. I'm very happy to be back there. I'm very grateful to Ian Chaffee for the opportunity to come back there to do the Liberty Chat show. And it should be a lot of fun. And I better write on my hand that I need to call him. Got all these different Ians I need to talk to all the time now. Call Ian. I actually have call Ian written on my hand faded out from yesterday. And now I'm just writing call Ian over that. Only now I gotta put... Chaffee down at the bottom so that I keep straight what the hell I'm writing about. All right, good. Yeah, so I got to get that audio all worked out and set up. That should be great. And again, that's starting back up. I did, quite a few episodes there for Liberty Chat. I don't know, interviewed Walter Block and a couple others, I forget. Anyway, Tom. So that was good, and that's starting back up again. Liberty Chat at libertychat.com this Sunday night at, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something? I don't remember. Look into it. I'll see if I can find out. Hey, it's only Tuesday. Leave me alone, man. I got time to get it together. I just want you to begin anticipating. All right, good. Okay, so that's all of that. Now, so here's back to Obama and the 10,000 troops here. I'd like to be a bit redundant on the show. Not from stuff I said earlier today, but stuff obviously we've covered before, but it's of the most extreme importance. And that is that when we're talking about withdrawing soldiers down to a 10,000 troop level in 2014, we're saying that on the heels of what was the Obama-Afghan surge, which was supposed to mimic the absolutely mythical success of the surge in Iraq, which that'll be a whole different, you know, segment of yelling. But anyway, based on the theory that the surge worked in Iraq, they decided they were going to do another surge worked under Obama beginning in 2009. And the thing of it is this, as soon as he came into power, there were about 30,000 troops there. He made that 60 immediately. And then he made that 90,000 troops. That summer, he added another 30,000. And then it was amazing the way, and there could have been give or take 5,000 here or there, or whatever, the way they actually deploy them compared to the reports, you know. But then they really kind of just ignored that that had ever even happened. They sort of acted like there already were, you know, between 60 and 90,000 troops there before all of the accusations. Do you remember now in the fall of 2009, all the accusations of Obama dithering? Oh, no. Stanley McChrystal, Barack Obama's quite inferior on the chain of command there, is accusing the president of not hurrying up and giving him the troops he needed to surge in Afghanistan. And they kept saying they wanted 60,000 troops and 60,000 troops, and he ended up settling on just 30,000, which again was on top of 60,000 he'd already sent. So it ended up being approximately 110,000, 120,000 troops by the time they were done. And here's the thing about it, is that Obama knew it wasn't going to work. And there's a guy named Vali Nasser, who was the right-hand man of Richard Holbrooke, who got the portfolio to be the top diplomat over there to make the deal. And I'll get into the deal in a second. But Vali Nasser told the story of how it was all politics and had nothing to do with actually winning the war. It was just that Rahm Emanuel had told Barack Obama, dude, you can't end the Iraq war and the Afghan war because the Republicans will call us sissies and you'll lose your next election. And Obama decided that his personal chance at an 8-year term of president was more important than any of the tens of thousands of people that would be killed. So he authorized the surge. And there's another guy whose name I can't pronounce, wrote a book called Little America, says the same thing. Obama refused to read a CIA report that told him, don't do it, it won't work, because he knew what it said. So he's guilty of murder. Tens of thousands of counts of murder for the Afghan surge.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is the great Eric Margolies. He's the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. His website is ericmargolies.com. Spell it like Margolis. ericmargolies.com.
And you can also find him at lourockwell.com and at unz.com. That's UNZ, unz.com. Welcome back to the show, Eric. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be back, Scott.
Very good to have you here. All right, so I just saw this thing. Usually you and I don't get to talk about good news. This must be good news that the Prime Minister of Pakistan traveled to India in order to attend the inauguration of India's new Prime Minister. And here are these countries that are at such odds all the time, and as far as I know, this is unprecedented, yeah?
Well, Scott, I don't want to rain on your happy parade here, I'm sorry. But, you know, when this happens periodically, the prime ministers get together, new hopes for peace in South Asia and all this, and it usually trails away to nothing. Or there's some kind of attack, and both sides are jumping up and down. So it remains to be seen, I would say, is the most cautiously guarded thing I can say.
Yeah. Now, do they usually do anything like this? Is this pretty much par for the course? Sometimes symbolic gestures of peace, but still
they
status
do.
Quo?
They do. In fact, I was just talking the other night back in 1988, when I was there, the Indians were threatening to go to war with Pakistan over Kashmir, as usual. And they had massed over 300,000 or 400,000 troops to an armor, a lot of armor, and to attack Pakistan. They were just about to launch the attack. It was called Operation Brass Tacks. And they were going to teach the bloody Pakistanis a lesson. And just then, as everybody was filled with war fever, President Zia-ul Haq of Pakistan, a gifted statesman, Zia jumped on an airplane and he flew to New Delhi to attend a cricket match there. And that upset the Indian war apple cart so much, having the president of Pakistan sitting there in New Delhi cheering with the crowds, that the whole crisis just blew over. It was a beautiful piece of political theater. I hope we see something like that again.
Yeah. All right, now, I'm sorry, because that phone is just killing us here, so please, and you're coming in nice and loud, so if you could hold that, the microphone as far away, maybe up
okay,
at even eye level
again.
Or something, I'm sure we'll still be able to hear you just fine.
I hope this is better.
Yeah, that actually sounds great right there. It's just the mic, I bet you there's a hole in the microphone in that handset or something is what it sounds like.
Sorry.
But no, it's okay because you're still coming in loud and clear even if you hold it quite far away. So I think it'll be okay like that. Okay, now, so, well, and there's a lot to fight about here, right? It's not just a matter of, hard feelings about some ancient thing. There's a major territorial dispute in Kashmir ongoing that never ratchets down below whatever level you call it.
That's right, Scott. I wrote a whole book on this subject. That's my War at the Top of the World, my first book exploring not only the history of the Kashmir dispute, which is the world's oldest current running international dispute, but the reasons for it and why the Indians and the Pakistanis can't bury the hatchet, a lot of psychological and historical reasons. But suffice it to say that Kashmir is the only Indian state that is majority Muslim. It's been misruled by the Indians ever since 1948. The majority of the population, Muslims, so there's a big Hindu and Sikh minority, the Muslims want union with neighboring Pakistan. India says over our dead bodies, and it would begin the dismemberment of the Indian Union, and anyway, we were never going to let the bloody Pakistanis get Kashmir, and so on and so forth. Mm. It's very dangerous. The two have fought 2.5 or 3 wars over Kashmir, and the next one could go nuclear because India is so outnumbers and outguns Pakistan that if there's a steep thrust by Indian forces into Pakistan, it may be forced to resort to nuclear weapons. The two sides are on a 3-minute hair trigger nuclear alert.
And do you have rough estimates of how many nukes each side holds?
Well, the best estimates I've seen is that the Indians have about 50 or 60 nuclear weapons and the Pakistanis have about 80.
Mm.
which is still plenty. I mean, Daniel Ellsberg keeps pointing to these studies of just how bad for the entire planet Earth even a very limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan would be in terms of the dust and the crop failures and the forest fires and the et cetera and all the refugee consequences and the whatever. It'd be an absolute nightmare, and not just limited to that area, but around the world there would be incredible consequences.
I cited in my book a Rand Corporation study, which suggested that a limited nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan would initially kill 2 million people and eventually kill 100 million, that it would pollute all the groundwater of the Indus and possibly the Ganges and other major rivers, and it would blow clouds of radioactive dust right around the globe. And I remember I was doing a radio show out west somewhere, and some irate farmer stopped his pickup truck and said, "Why should I care about this stuff?" I said, "Because nuclear radiation may come down showering down on your head if there's an Indian-Pakistani war."
Yeah, and on your crops. So much for your crop-selling business, Mr. Farmer who doesn't care. Well, now, so how about this? I'm the emperor of the world empire, and I name you to be my special envoy to, damn it, work this thing out. Everybody compromise. Whatever Eric says, go along with it, damn it. And we're going to bury this hatchet, and we're going to all move forward in peace and freedom and trade from here. What's the scoop? What do you do, Mr. Holbrook?
Well, to me, the logical solution has neither side will give it up. It's what the Solomon and the baby question again. I think the answer is to eliminate the internal borders, known as the line of control in Kashmir, and let Kashmir just be a joint Indian-Pakistani state with an independent status, sort of call it a Monaco or something like that. And let the people there do what they want and withdraw all military troops from Kashmir. However, there is a slight problem, and that is that when Kashmir was divided up, the Indians got the lion's share, the Pakistanis got the smaller third, but China up in the north in a very remote region called Aksai Chin is also grabbed part of Kashmir. Mm. And the Pakistanis say that that Indian-controlled Ladakh is also part of traditional Kashmir. And the Indians say that all of northern Pakistan, Baltistan, for example, where the mountain climbing expeditions go way up north, that's all part of Kashmir, too. So there are many conflicting claims. The best way was just to say it's an open state.
Yeah, right, an autonomous zone with a mayor or something, you know, and keep it light. Open trade with everybody.
Swiss administrators.
Yeah, I mean, this is my whole thing. I mean, it sounds so stupid in this context, but this is what I'm always saying about Israel and Palestine, that if they even had anything like a kind of enlightenment minarchist state there, where the government's only job was protecting people's rights, then it wouldn't matter who was in charge of the damn thing. It's only when the government's job is, you know, completely looting and oppressing one side against the other that it becomes very important who's running the place, you know?
Well, that's right. And mixed into the political dispute is the historical dispute. There's the hatred of Muslims and Indian and Hindus, which is very important. The Hindus hate
In fact,
the Sikhs.
Let's pick that up on the other side of this. I'm sorry, we got to go out and take this break, Eric. But when we get back, we'll talk about this Muslim-Hindu split and the bad blood and the new leader of India, the BJP party, and all of that on the other side of this break with the great Eric Margolies, ericmargolies.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the thing here, man. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show.
My website is scotthorton.org. Stop by, check out the interview archives. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And full show archives, too, and whatever you want. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Hey, you can follow Eric Margolies, at Eric Margolies. There, spell it like Margolis. On Twitter as well. Welcome back to the show. Welcome back from that incredibly long break. Eric, thank you for holding there.
Cheers, Scott.
Very happy to have you. Okay, so now, we were interrupted by the break, and you were beginning to discuss, some of the part of the reason for the inability of, people with power to come to some kind of peaceful, long-term resolution about Kashmir is because of just the racial and tribal hatreds and prejudices and resentments going way back between Muslims and Hindus. And that brought up to me the question about this new prime minister. Is it president or prime minister in India?
He is a prime minister.
Prime minister, right. I thought so. Narendra Modi. And he's from the BJP party. And I read this thing about how it was him and his party. I don't know if he led the thing, but it was his party that had done this pogrom that had killed 2,000 Muslims back in 2001 or 2002. And I'm reminded of what Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, pointed out about that, was that Bin Laden had put out a podcast saying, you see how they are? They never complain about anti-Muslim violence, not in China, not in Russia, not in India. You can kill all the Muslims you want, but oh boy, are they crocodile tears over human rights wherever it's in their interest to be in the interest of human rights. And that Scheuer says that was a point that he had constantly made about American attitudes toward wars against Muslims in Chechnya, in the Uyghur province, of course, and in wherever it was in India where this had happened. Anti-Muslim violence in these countries and American attitudes toward it. And then, but that it turns out that was this guy who's now the prime minister of India. That was him and his party that had done that pogrom that Condoleezza Rice refused to mention.
That's right. And Scheuer's absolutely right. Muslims don't count. And there are many other examples. For example, Bin Laden also cited the destruction of Beirut in 1982 by the Israelis, where they pounded it to pieces with artillery, as his role, why he wanted to see New York heavily damaged as well. But it's true, and this massacre that occurred in Gujarat state in India, one of the more advanced regions of India, where Modi was governor and he refused to intervene in this horrible massacre. It may have been up to 5,000 people. We don't know. Many were burned alive by Hindu mobs. That happens frequently across India. This was just the most egregious example, but there's what the Indians call communal violence all over. There are bombs shot off by Muslims. There are mobs who hack and burn people to death and rape the women. It's very brutal. And the feeling was that Modi, as governor, was cheering on the Indian mobs because he is a Hindu chauvinist nationalist, as is his party, the Bharata Janata Party, whose background is very sinister, Scott. It was founded in the 1930s at the time of fascism in Europe as a form of Indian fascist movement. And to this day, young people dress in uniforms. They do calisthenics and military drills. And they're extremely right-wing. We would call them fascists if they were in Europe. It's a uniquely Indian phenomena in that part of the world. But the BJP has a section called the RSS, sort of a subsection, which is extremely militant, extremely violent. We don't know if Modi, who's been very extreme in the past, is going to stay extreme or he's going to hew to the center.
Well, is it even true that the so-called international community cares that now that he's one of their peers as a world leader that there'll be pressure on him, they'll let him know that they're looking at him real closely? Not like they're going to do anything about it, really, but I mean, it's different being a party leader on a local level and being an international leader of the tide for most populous state on the planet.
Well, the U.S. government at least did something right once, and it banned Modi from, wouldn't give him a visa because implicated in this mass murder, this pogrom. Mm. But I'm sure now things will change, that he's head of India, and India offers huge business opportunities to the United States. So we're going to close our eyes to a lot of wrongdoings there.
Right. And now these are the guys, the BJP, that killed Gandhi, right?
That's correct, yes. Not the BJ party, but its predecessors, its core groups, the RSS, the Shiv Sena in Bombay. These were the Hindu extremists.
All right. And so, so all the minorities and the communists and the different people who had lost the election, are they scared to death of these new guys coming to power? I mean, is this really Mussolini in the brown shirts, or it's less bad than that?
I don't think so. India has its own internal inertia, and a great flood of water is breaking on the Indian continent. But by give it a few months, and most of it will trickle into the ground and disappear. India is such a huge and complex country. There are all kinds of regional parties that hold a great deal of power in India, so that no prime minister is as all-powerful as we think he is. And the BJP will come under attack very soon. Nevertheless, many Indians are welcoming it because the Congress Party, its rival, has been around too long. It's too corrupt. It's grown stale and tired. It's clearly time for a change.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw on CNN International, they were talking about how, hey, all right, the free market economics come to India and all this. And I was thinking, wait, aren't these guys the nationalists? That's not quite libertarianism, I don't think, y'all.
That's true, but Modi, at least as governor of Gujarat, has been very business friendly and has promoted
business.
Which
is not the same thing as free market at all.
That's quite a nice point. Thank you.
Yeah. We all know how and why CNN likes to conflate those things, but we won't let them get away with that here.
That's right.
All right. Well, so, dang. So tell me about Nawaz Sharif. He's the other character in the play that that was acted out this morning, going to visit over there. How's he doing? Mr. Formerly Most Corrupt in Pakistan, now again?
Well, that's a mouthful, most corrupt in Pakistan. I've met and interviewed Nawaz Sharif when he was previously prime minister before Musharraf kicked him out. And Nawaz is not the most brilliant, fiery statesman. He's kind of low-key and he's not a good talker. But he's a conservative businessman from Punjab. He and his brother Shahbaz, they appear to be on top of the political spectrum. The Bhuttos completely disgraced themselves just the way the Gandhis did in India. He's a moderate Muslim. He's sort of close to the Americans. He's cautious, I should say. He's not the man, I think, who's going to make big changes in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I guess the status quo is still short of nukes going off, but I did read a thing about how, well, like you were saying earlier, about how they may feel forced into the position of having to use nukes, that at least some reports were being re-reported here, hearsay style, that they had actually moved some of these smaller tactical nukes to the battlefield and relinquished command to the battlefield commanders, because there's no use to you in a warehouse. They've got to be available, and that's where they need them, is at the frontier.
Well, I sure hope not, Scott, because, as I said, their primitive early warning systems give 3, maybe 5 minutes of advanced warning. Now, in that part of the world, a lot of things don't work right. Phones, trains, planes, electricity,
right,
you name it. And, a report comes in India that a radar site has picked up incoming missiles, which are presumed to be nuclear-tipped. Well, the government in Delhi, if they can find them, has, 3 to 5 minutes to respond, or else they lose their nuclear arsenal.
Right.
That's a horrible situation. It shouldn't be allowed to happen, but it does.
Yeah. Well, America and Russia have almost come to nuclear war based on mistakes, estimates of between, a dozen or 2 dozen times now. over.
That's right.
And saved by just good hunches by officers who refused to do what they were supposed to do in such situations, thank God. So,
thank God.
Yeah, no doubt about what
the
real danger they're playing with there.
Is if they have to have nukes, at least to keep them disassembled,
right,
so they're not ready to fire on a moment's notice. Mm.
Yeah, which tell the liberals in D.C. to pipe down about going in there and seizing them, because that just makes them more reluctant to keep them in pieces. Like that.
Exactly.
All right, we're all out of time. Thank you so much for your time. You're the best, Eric.
Cheers, Scott. Always a pleasure.
Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, XKeyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM. And I'm at scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. Got a great group of guys in there today, scotthorton.org/chat. And our next guest up, surprise guest, is our good friend Ray McGovern. Mostly he writes for consortiumnews.com. You can also find him at raymcgovern.com, his own website there. And he gives speeches. What's the name of the church that you work with there that sends you around giving speeches talking about peace, Ray?
Yeah, it's an unusual church, Scott. It's called the Ecumenical Church of the Savior. It's based here in Washington. They think that what I'm doing is also what church should be doing, and they give me some modest support so that I can actually travel around.
Well, that's absolutely great, and I know for a fact you're a great speaker, not just from interviewing you 100 times, but from seeing you speak as well, so I highly recommend that service to anyone who's interested in having you out. But anyway, so... also, what you need to know about Ray McGovern is that he was CIA, not a, throat-slitting coup d'etat maniac, but he was just an analyst there at CIA. Not just. He was a great analyst there at CIA for 27 years, and now he is a co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he's really good on everything. And this one is called Washington Post Seeks U.S. Patrolled Safe Zone in Syria. Oh, say it ain't so, Ray.
I'm sorry?
I begged you to please say it ain't so.
Well, it is so. I mean, we have a responsibility to protect everybody that Israel wants protected, Scott. Let's face it. This really goes to the core of the question here. When you ask what interest does the United States have in trying to depose Bashar al-Assad, as we have been for the last 3 years, and keep that terrible struggle going in Syria, well, we have a very marginal interest unless you appreciate that the people who are running this policy, the so-called neocons, are the same people who have difficulty distinguishing between what they perceive to be the national or the security interests of Israel on the one hand, and the security interests of America on the other. Now, let me be clear, as the president always says, I don't dispute their right to their opinion. Everyone has the right to their own opinions. I just don't think that they should be running U.S. policy, which they have been in Syria and in places like Iraq and even Afghanistan to an extent. That's not right. So what we have here is a situation where we were about to attack Syria last August. Actually, the Israelis had been warned the attack was coming within 24 hours. That was on the 30th of August. And the French had their fire bombers on the tarmac, okay, warming up, okay? And what happened? Well, finally somebody got to President Obama, and we know that it was a combination of my former colleagues, to their credit, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, and they said, hey, Mr. President, you've been fed a line here about those chemical attacks outside Damascus. We don't know. No matter how many times Secretary Kerry says we do know, we don't know that the Syrian government was responsible for those. As a matter of fact, we have more evidence that was probably the rebels for obvious reasons. They wanted to mousetrap you into attacking on their behalf. They wanted to cross the red line, so to speak, and blame it on the Syrian government. So these are the people, and Kerry is among them, that got us inches away from what Kerry called a, quote, unbelievably short, small war, end quote. And we know from Cy Hirsch's reporting that it was anything but. It was shock and awe part two. The stealth bombers and everybody else was going to be thrown at Syria, and there was going to be no unbelievably short war. I think that's what Dempsey told the president. And finally, the president came to his senses. Now, the sequel to that is what's relevant here. Who bailed the president out? I mean, everybody. Everybody was down in the mouth from the neocon side. I was at the top of the CNN building the Monday after, and Paul Wolfowitz and Joe Lieberman are virtually crying. They weren't going to get their war, okay? So how is the president going to protect himself from the likes of them and John McCain? Well, guess who helped out? Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. He said, you know, let's work out a deal where we get the Syrians to destroy all their chemical weapons. And they did. Now, was John Kerry in on that? No, they went around his back, because the Monday before he said that will never happen. That's never going to happen. So the point here is that the neocons hate Putin, as we used to say in the Bronx about Gene Autry, you know, and the Iroquois Indians. You know, they hate him yet from another picture. They hate him yet from Syria. And they also hate him for the help that he's given our president with respect to getting the Iranian nuclear problem resolved. So what did they do? Right after all the Syrian stuff went down, they decided, well, let's do Ukraine. And in case your listeners don't know this already, the U.S., NATO, and our National Endowment for Democracy mounted a coup using neo-fascists, neo-Nazis, and other right-wing folks, a violent coup on the 22nd of February, ousting the duly elected government, however corrupt it was, of Yanukovych, and imposing this new regime. Now, that's why they do that? Well, they wanted to give Russia a bloody nose. They may have thought they might wean Ukraine away from the Russian domination part of the world there and then get it into first into the EU on a temporary basis and then into NATO. That just was not going to happen. So whether the neocons realized that or not, it was a no-lose situation for them, because if they got a bloody nose, they could blame it on Obama, and the atmosphere and relations between Putin and Obama would be destroyed, which it has been. Now, I have some hope that in the next week or so, there are reports that Obama is going to meet with Putin in connection with the D-Day celebrations on June 6th. I have some hope that Putin, having been very restrained in this whole imbroglio, has persuaded Obama that, you know, they can deal with this new situation with the new president elected in Ukraine, act like adults, sit around the table, satisfy the interests of the various nations that are represented there, not only Russia and the U.S., but of course, first and foremost, Ukraine and the various parts of the Ukraine, and they work things out. So I have more hope in the wake of this election, but I have to say that those folks out there in the eastern Ukraine, I can see why they would want to seize that airfield, and I can see why the Ukrainian army would drive them away. So that stuff has to cease, and we'll have to see if the new president has guts enough to tell his army, look, hold your fire here. We're going to work a deal out.
Right. Well, and that's an important question, whether the recent attacks are the old regime or the new one, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah, it's eminently sensible to suggest that everyone sit around a table. The Russians have been suggesting that for 4 weeks now. Mm. And finally, with this new president who says he's willing to talk to the folks in the East. Now, please understand, there are a lot of crazies out there in the East, as there are in places like Odessa. I mean, there are people, there are forces loosed here that are very much akin to the ones that were loosed by the Nazi invasion of the Ukraine back in the early 40s. So these people have to be marginalized. They have to be seen for who they really are, and who they really are people who gain not more than 1%, not more than 1% of the vote on last Sunday. So I think the die is cast. I have always been optimistic that, number one, Putin would act in an adult way, in a restrained way, and the fact that he agreed to accept the results of the election, even while saying, remember that the...
Well, wrap this point up real quick here. We got to take this break.
Okay.
Oh, or not. We'll pick it up on the other side of this break here with Russia's promise to respect the results of the vote and hopes for the new president of Ukraine, and then we'll get back into the war in Syria, Israel's interests, and Al-Qaeda and the rest with the great Ray McGovern. Just a minute.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. It's Scott Horton. Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern. And listen, I mean, you guys understand how it is, right? This isn't even a matter of opinion. It's an objective, scientific, mathematical fact that the single most important thing in the whole wide world is the relationship between the U.S. state and the Russian one. Because H-bombs. Enough to kill us all. Enough to destroy civilization for hundreds and hundreds of years. And maybe to destroy all of mankind. So, can't have that. Gotta get along with them, no matter what. Even if Putin's killing little kids with his bare hands live on TV, our government and their government still have to get along. And so, Ray is talking about the prospects for peace here in Ukraine, which could be a horrible flashpoint. Doesn't take much imagination to see, to run a couple thought experiments and see how a real civil war in Ukraine could turn into a much greater conflict with the West, between the West and Russia, or the U.S. and Russia. So anyway, but the problem is, well, people aren't willing to really talk with each other. I mean, they had an agreement that didn't include the people of the East. And so they didn't feel bound by it. So they went ahead and had their little referendum anyway. And now they've had this presidential election, and the people of the East seem to have a lot of reason to feel like they're frozen out, basically like the Sunnis, who didn't even really get a chance to win in Iraq in 05, something like that. So that could just make matters this much worse. And Ray, before the break, you were saying what we need is a table big enough for both and all factions, as many factions as possible in Ukraine, for the Americans, the Russians, the new president, the newly elected president of Ukraine, and to see if we can find some kind of compromise here, because the all or nothing has brought us nothing but trouble.
That's exactly right, Scott. And when you talk about the necessity for the U.S. and Russia to get along, that's less pressing. That's less evident to people now. I mean, I went into the Army the week after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Okay, I was down at Fort Benning, and we had no weapons to train with. You know why? Because they were all in Key West, okay? And our Joint Chiefs of Staff were just really plumbing for a war on Russia, because we could destroy them. Well, we got to get those commies now, and it would only, we'd only suffer maybe 20 million casualties, but they would suffer 60 million. That was the thought at the time. And a responsible adult came onto the scene. His name was John Kennedy. He realized how close he had come, and so did Nikita Khrushchev. They worked this thing out, but my point is, that they were under the impact of how close they had come to incinerating at least half of the world. Now today, people have forgotten that. These younger people have no sense of history. The Cold War, much less World War II, where people forget Russia and we were allies. So this needs to be worked out. It can be worked out. But to do that, the president's got to face down the people who have been running the show there, the Victoria Nulands, the Samantha Powers, the Susan Rices, the very, very tough guy women we have in the White House and the UN. He's got to face them down and say, look, there's a reality here that I just learned about. There was this Cold War. There was a Cuban Missile Crisis. And we don't need this kind of thing because our national interests are not involved in Ukraine and Russia's are. Now, I'd like to just pick up one other point here. Exactly 50 years ago, when I came on as an analyst of Soviet foreign policy, my portfolio was China, okay? And in those days, there was an enmity between China and that Soviet Union you could cut with a knife, okay? They hated each other. And we became so used to the fact that they were going to hate each other forever and ever and ever, that we really were slow to see the signs of rapprochement coming just 20 years later. And now, what now? Now an incredible economic deal between Russia and China. What's my point? My point is that the Russians no longer have to curry favor with the U.S. so that they can make sure the U.S. doesn't steal a march vis-a-vis China. In this triangular relationship, all important is the fact that the Russians have seen an ally now rather than an implacable enemy in China, and they signed this deal. It's the biggest economic deal in world history, and it looks like the Russians and the Chinese are going to be economically and politically tied in a way that they had never been before. Now, did the Ukraine have something to do with this? Well, yes, but it's not a direct result of that. I see the Ukraine crisis developed by the U.S. and the EU as the catalyst here. We've had 25 years since the Berlin Wall fell, and the Russians have been looking at us and see if we're able to keep our promises not to move NATO east, and they've found out they can't trust us, okay? Meanwhile, they've been developing this relationship with China, and that's the sea change, okay? That's what's 180 degrees different from the way it was in the 60s and the early 70s when Kissinger and Nixon very adroitly played this triangular relationship and had the Russians coming to agreements with us that they would not otherwise have done. Now the game has completely changed, and when you look at it from a 50-year perspective, well, for example, annual trade between the Soviet Union and China in the mid-60s was $200 million. You know what it is now? $95 billion. It's a big difference there. So meanwhile, as the U.S. has shown itself intent on moving NATO to the east, and the Russians have said, no farther, forget about the Ukraine, that was one regime change too far. Meanwhile, Putin and the others had developed this very cozy relationship with China, which desperately needs the natural gas that is now going to be financed, the exploration and the production, not only by Russia, but by the Chinese themselves. So this is a very big deal, and it should not be laughed off as, something that, is kind of incidental to the Ukraine. Ukraine is, in large measure, the final proof that Putin and Lavrov have come to the realization that, Obama, he might have good thoughts, or he might want a direct policy in a different way. But whether he does or whether he's completely complicit with these neocons, the effect is the same. We're going to develop a relationship with China. And, talk about the end of the empire. Well, this is one benchmark, Scott. This is one benchmark where the empire is falling apart. And, it's just going to be a matter of, my grandchildren are going to college. It could be a very, very different world. And I've suggested that half of them study Russian and the other half study Chinese.
Well, as a non-American imperialist, I'm perfectly happy seeing Russia and China getting along. After all, that's objectively, scientifically, mathematically the second most important relationship in the whole wide world. Because H-bombs, you know, same difference. So I'm happy to see peace and commerce breaking out between everybody in the world. That's the good part of globalism, is the private, you know, business relationships and trade. It's all the government and their alliances, like NATO. You keep mentioning NATO. That's the military alliance we're threatening them with. These are the things, these are the tripwires that lead to wars and even world wars, is those kinds of obligations. And you know, hopefully you can stay and give me one more segment, because I got to get back to Syria and Israel here.
Sure, happy to do that.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm in the middle of talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and now hardcore peacenik, co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, which I don't know how they let you even live in D.C. Seems like that'd be against the rules, Ray. Sanity, what's that got to do with anything here? But, go ahead.
No, I say actually when we set up our organization back in January of 2003, 3 months before the war in Iraq, there wasn't a lot of sanity going on here in Washington.
I thought you were going to say the zoning commission came and kicked our asses right into Virginia. But anyway, we're talking about how wouldn't it be nice if we had some sanity here. Which brings us back to Syria, which has got to be the most confounded whatever the heck you use for your verbs and things there. You talk about in your article, you provide two pretty severe evidences of Israeli influence on America's foreign policy of supporting the rebels in Syria here. And this was brought up originally in the context of one of the reasons, and this is in your article, again, Washington Post seeks U.S.-patrolled safe zone in Syria. One of the big deals that the neocons, one of the reasons that the neocons pushed the Ukraine crisis to the degree they did, is your thesis and Robert Perry's, is that they were just trying to do anything they could, and this was something to help disrupt America, specifically Obama's burgeoning relationship with Putin, and them working together on the Iran nuclear issue and on perhaps coming to some kind of agreement in the case of Syria. And you say here that, no, the Israelis don't want that, and therefore the neoconservatives, and that would include Victoria Nuland, Robert Kagan's wife, don't want that. And so what makes you say that, Ray?
Well, if you look at, if you ask the question why Washington should care so much about, sponsoring more regime change in Syria, the answer is pretty simple. It's because Israel cares about preventing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from prevailing, whatever that means. Now, about this time last year, he started prevailing, okay? He was kicking the rebels out of very, very big strongholds they had in Syria, and it looked like the rebels might just take it on the chin and that Assad would win a definitive victory, not in all of Syria, but most of it. And so there was a need, a felt need on the part of Israel to prevent that from happening. Now, how's the best way to prevent that from happening? Get the U.S. involved militarily. How can you do that? Well, someone told Obama to draw a red line. If chemical weapons were used, then the U.S. would have to change its calculus and do something drastic like get involved militarily. So how do you do that? Well, you cause a chemical event. Now, John Kerry said 35 times from the State Department podium on 30 August that we know it was Bashar al-Assad that did that. He was not telling the truth. He didn't know. No one knew. We do know now, at least to my satisfaction as an intelligence analyst, it was not Bashar al-Assad's government. It was a combination of the rebels, Turkey, and others that could easily make the sarin that was used. The sarin that was used, the British found out, is not the sarin that is in Syrian government stocks or used to be. So what do we have here? Who profits from turmoil in Syria? And who would profit from the prospect of getting the U.S. involved militarily? Well, of course, you got the various groups, the rebel groups. But what's been really clear over the last couple of years is that the Netanyahu government in Israel has powerful incentive to keep Washington engaged in yet another area, another regime change. The Israeli priority is also driven by its view of Iran as Syria's most its primary protector. Now, this came through in all places, in the New York Times, the same day that we, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, wrote a memo to the president saying, look, our colleagues still on active duty in the agency are telling us that it's not true that it was Bashar al-Assad that was responsible for those chemical attacks. Rather, it was the rebels, okay? Now, on that same day, there was a New York Times report, coincidence, Judy Rudoran, writing from Jerusalem, she addressed this thinking from Israel, and she said, for Jerusalem, the status quo in Syria, horrific as it may be, this is a direct quote, seems preferable to either a victory by Mr. Assad's government or a strengthening of the rebel groups. This is a quote from a former Israeli consul general in New York, according to Ruderin in the Washington Times, in the New York Times. Quote, this is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want one to win. We'll settle for a tie. And he continues, let them both bleed, hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria. Well, from an Israeli perspective, if you look at it in those blunt terms, as long as Sunni and Shia are shooting each other, killing each other, not only in Syria, mind you, but in the whole area now, well, Israel feels relatively safe. So they wanted the U.S. in. They tried to mousetrap Obama. They came within one day of successfully doing that. And our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and some of my old colleagues at CIA told the president, look, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as an unbelievably short, small war in the Middle East. Kerry doesn't know what he's talking about. He's been deceived or he's deliberately lying and saying he's sure that it was Assad government that did this. Kerry is not a strategic thinker. You know, we give him due for driving boats up the Mekong, but that does not make you a strategic thinker. We know what war is like, Mr. President. Those real tough gals you have in the White House and at the UN and elsewhere, they don't know diddly about war. This is going to be a real second Iraq. And the president, to his credit, changed his mind within 22 hours. I remember after Kerry spoke, we all thought, well, the strike from those cruise missile ships in the Eastern Mediterranean is inevitable. And we're out in the White House the next day. And the president goes out to the Rose Garden, 2 o'clock, and he says, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has told me that we're in position to shoot these cruise missiles at Syria, but we don't have to do it today or tomorrow or next week or next month, and so I'm going to go to Congress to get appropriate authorization. We were delirious with, like, we could hardly believe what we heard him say. The French, they were in high dudgeon. The
Israelis, isn't that great? It's still unbelievable. You can't even talk about that without taking me back to the time that, look, the president is backing down. It's absolutely unreal. Sorry, I just get so excited again.
Yeah. Well, you know, amazing. He did the right thing. And the question is, this didn't stop the neocons. As a matter of fact, it gave them more incentive. They had been working on Ukraine for a long time. I mean, Victoria Nuland says $5 billion had been invested in what she calls the Ukrainian aspirations toward the West, end quote. Well, that means covert action. That means the National Endowment for Democracy. That means they were in place. They had 65 projects, which my colleague Bob Perry dug out of somewhere. 65 projects from the National Endowment for Democracy in Ukraine alone. So the coup on 22 February was well planned in advance, but the impetus came after Syria and after the when the Sochi Olympics were going on, with Putin distracted, all that kind of stuff happened right under his nose. He could hardly believe this, and he just made it very clear that if you're thinking of enfolding Ukraine, including our only warm water naval base in Crimea, into NATO, forget about it. Forget about it. Right. They've had the naval base in Crimea since the time of Catherine the Great, for God's sake. That's the time of our own revolution. They weren't about to let that be endangered by coup plotters or coup succeeders in Kiev. It was a no-brainer for me that Putin would go in and protect that part of the Ukraine that, after all, had been given to the Ukraine as a sort of accident of history by Khrushchev, an Ukrainian who thought that would bolster his position when he took over from Stalin. It did bolster his position. In those days, it didn't matter, of course, because they were all part of the Soviet Union. Now it mattered all of a sudden, and Putin wasn't going to sit. People don't follow his speeches. I read his major speech at the time. You know what he said? He said, we think that the NATO sailors are really good guys,
yeah.
But we don't think that we should be in a position of visiting them in their naval base in the Crimea. We'd much rather them come visit us.
That's a pretty nice way of putting it. You're not getting my Navy base.
Yeah, right. So what's happened was totally predictable. As I say, it doesn't faze the neocons at all. And what's going to be really interesting, Scott, is tomorrow when the president speaks at West Point, what kind of attack he's going to take, not only on Ukraine, but on Syria. Because if he repeats these unfounded rumors that Kerry and some others have put about there, that the Syrians are still using chemical weapons. And guess what? Chlorine, like World War II chlorine.
Which even the Secretary of the Pentagon, the Secretary of War, Hagel, says he's seen no evidence of that. So that throws cold water on Kerry and his co-conspirator theorists.
Yeah, well, you know, when right after Hagel says, I don't see any evidence of that, Kerry gets up, and this is what he said. This is worth quoting. Quote, on the issue of evidence, I suspect I haven't talked with Hagel about what it was in mind, and he was referring to something that I don't know. I have seen evidence. I don't know how verified it is. It's not verified. It hasn't been confirmed, but I've seen the raw data and suggest that there may have been, as France has suggested, a number of instances in which chlorine had been used in the conduct of war, end quote.
Yeah, and George Bush found some weapons of mass destruction-related program activities in Iraq, too.
Yeah, and he was more articulate than John Kerry.
Unbelievable.
If the president, I'm serious now, if the president repeats these rumors, which nobody says has been confirmed, there have been no victims lying around, and it's even worse a charade than the one on 21 August, if he does that, hold on to your hats, because that means he's caved completely into the neocons, and he's going to give shoulder-fired anti-aircraft weapons to the Syrian rebels, and God knows what's going to happen after that. It will be a repeat of giving such weapons to the Afghan rebels back in the 90s.
Yeah. Well, I hope the Israelis are happy when they look north and see guys flying the Al-Qaeda flag there in the Golan Heights or just on the other side of the border there from the occupied Golan Heights. So I guess make your bed and lie in it, folks.
They wouldn't tolerate that, of course, Scott, and that's what I talk about when I mean a wider war in the Middle East. The Israelis themselves should realize there are limits to which they should press these things. But, the neocons, they...
Well, in fact, wait a minute. Now, let me interrupt you here for a sec. Sorry,
sure.
But Eric Margulies, I put this to him before and said, well, now, hey, come on now. from the Israeli point of view, wouldn't they prefer to have Bashar al-Assad, who might as well be Mossad, I like to say, because of just how docile he's been in his relationship with Israel his entire time in power? I mean, yeah, he still backs Hezbollah and this and that, but here's a guy that they can negotiate with. In fact, Bush even stopped them from negotiating with Assad a few times back under Olmert. And how in the world could they prefer a bunch of bin Ladenites to old Reliable, you know? Margulies said, hey, Al-Qaeda's still just pinprick nothing compared to an actual state. And so they would prefer chaos and outlaw suicide bomber crazies running around everywhere for as long as it lasts to having a state with a real army and a tax base and nothing else to do except look south at them.
Yeah, I'd put I agree in large part, but I put a little different wrinkle on that. What I'm saying here is that the Israelis prefer no solution. When this guy was asked, what's your preferred outcome in Syria, he said, no outcome. Keep them fighting each other. As long as the Bashar government is doing okay, but we don't want it to win. So how do we get it not to win? We get the U.S. involved militarily. Now, if the U.S. starts providing these weapons to the rebels, whatever rebels they find there, this is going to be a notch up in this war, right. And my God, it's just going to be getting out of hand because some of these rebels will shoot down an Israeli plane, and Israelis will retaliate and will be off and running.
Well, so remember, though, but like you were saying before, it was revealed in Hirsch's bit there that the campaign that they had put together was going to be humongous and very well could have been a real regime change type of a war. Or, you know, like in Libya, I mean, there were some special forces and spies and whatever, but for the most part, the Libya war was fought from the air. And it seems like if you really break out the B-52s, you can bring down Damascus, right?
Well, yes and no. You know, I'm an infantry officer, okay? There are very, very strict limits as to what bombing can do. Look what we did in North Vietnam. No regime has ever, in all of history, given up solely under bombing. You need to send the infantry in, and my God, if Obama doesn't realize that, somebody ought to tell him right quick, because bombing is not going to do it, even to a regime like Assad's. And, you know, it just will ratchet up the whole situation. The Russians will not stand by idly. They're interested in that part of the world, as well they should be. And so I just hope that tomorrow at West Point, the president takes a more responsible, more adult line on Syria and on Ukraine. And it's going to be really interesting to see what he tells those cadets. By the way, you'll be the first to hear this, but you really ought to see Medea Benjamin in her new West Point uniform, and look for her in the third row at the speech tomorrow. Don't tell anybody.
Hey, thanks for the pro tip there, Ray. Appreciate it. And thanks for your time again. You're always very generous.
You're most welcome. Take care.
Appreciate it. That's the great Ray McGovern, everybody. He's writing at consortiumnews.com with Robert Perry. He's also done a hell of a lot of really great work on Ukraine, too. I urge you to read everything at consortiumnews.com. And you can find him at raymcgovern.com. And so I think looks like we blew through that whole commercial break and back again. And so good. Hey, everybody, sorry that you missed a little bit of that interview during the commercial break. We went on, but the recording will include the whole thing there at scotthorton.org. I don't know how he didn't hear that bumper music playing. Oops. But I just couldn't get him to stop, and then I thought, well, I still want to talk then. As long as we're off into the commercial, might as well go ahead and keep on discussing. Anyway, so that was the great Ray McGovern. Yeah, he's good on that stuff. Coming up, Phil Giraldi. We'll be covering some of the same ground with Phil, but it'll be different. Another former CIA guy. Both of these honest former CIA guys. Well, you use your own judgment, but I like them. And they're really anti. And here, Phil is just as mad as hell in this article about America picking a fight with Russia, China, and Iran right now when we ought to be making peace with all three. So we're going to let him have his say, and then I'll try to come up with some questions, too. So that'll be good. And but now I got a little bit of time to kill before Phil joins us on the show. So a couple of things to talk about here, and there's a lot, and it's not necessarily in order of importance as much as, well, within order of importance, it's also within order of what I thought of just now. And so I wanted to mention a couple of things about Greenwald and the NSA, this and that. First of all, there's a story coming out that is maybe overly simplifyingly paraphrasing what Greenwald has said. But then again, I think Greenwald was being pretty clear about what he meant, that the big story, and it won't be the very, very last story, but the big story, you know, working up to it like a fireworks display, he has implied, and I don't have the exact language in front of me here, but he has implied will reveal who in America the NSA has been illegally spying on, who they've really been focusing on. And, I mean, I don't know how comprehensive that is, how many names that is, how many organizations that is. I have no idea. Do you? Are they all Muslims? Do they include the staff of antiwar.com? I don't know. They include the listeners to this show? I don't know. Always thought it'd be a point of pride to be on the red list or whatever it is, right? But I don't know. I'd kind of rather not be on any list now that I think about it. Thank you very much. Let someone else be honored by the threat. I want so badly, for the story to be that the NSA has been keeping close tabs on the leaders of every state government in America and the leaders of the congressional committees, if not the entire Congress, and all of their staff. Oh man, I want a war between the legislative and executive branches on this spying. And I mean a really pissed off, let's go to war and let's see who passes laws and let's see who controls budgets around here, you son of a bitch, kind of a war. Yeah, let's have a war. Damn it, I'm telling you, seriously, if Greenwald comes out and says, yeah, they've been spying on Scott Horton because of his association with antiwar.com, I'm going to be really disappointed. I want to see that they are spying on every lieutenant governor in America. That's what I want to see. Oh, you know they are, right? They gotta be, right? What, they're excluding them all? Are they double-checking them all? And printing out files and keeping them in cabinets. Can you imagine that the NSA aren't doing that yet? Leaders of the MSM, Fitzy G says, yeah, how about Roger Ailes? How about they keep track of his every move? Let's see a war between Fox News and the national security state. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Yeah. Let's have a war. I mean, a turf war. Inside the checks and balances of the separations of powers of the limited constitutional American Republic. Yeah, let's get it on! All right, I'm sorry, that sounds silly. Let's abolish the state. But in the meantime, let's have a giant fight. Oh, I want to know all. I hope that when he publishes it, that he also goes ahead and publishes all the dirt on all the committee chairmen, too. We'll see what happens. Oh, man. If it's just a bunch of, Muslim nobodies who have every right in the world to not be surveilled, that's going to be disappointing. It'll be horrible and scandalous, and it won't lead to any accountability for anyone because, you know, Muslims are a very small minority in America, and nobody else seems to care about their natural individual human rights to be free. Except, you know, libertarians and some leftists. But, you know, the average American consensus is, who? I don't care about them. Spy on them, not me. Real big of you, America. Thanks. But anyway, if it's just a bunch of Muslims and you know, completely harmless, moderate Sunni mosques and, you know, guys that sell black market cigarettes for Hezbollah or whatever the crap, I'm going to be bummed out, man. I want to see a full scale James Madison, Federalist Paper number 10. Ambition must be made to check ambition. In other words, let's have giant pissing contests all over Washington, D.C. in all directions and in everybody's eye and bring them all down. You know, I was arguing with this horrible right-wing idiot. He was just some idiot, dude. I mean, everything he said was some stupid non sequitur. It wasn't even an argument. But his whole thing was Snowden is a traitor, blah, blah, blah. Well, some third guy jumped in and said, obviously, Snowden is a CIA man who was sent to destroy the NSA. Duh. Or he didn't say duh, but it was something like that. Like, just look at it. Come on. It's so obvious. And I thought, hey, at least that's funny and interesting, right? Actually, I wonder if there's something to that. Certainly the CIA sent the FBI to bring down David Petraeus in his coup d'etat over the CIA director spot. Well, he didn't want to be there for the end of the defeat of the Afghan war. See, his number one priority was passing the buck. So he went to CIA to write up some CIA reports about how the war was going great, at least up until a little while ago. And then he was brought down because, according to Giraldi, the CIA sick. And you know what? There were more reports like this. I can't remember, but there were, you know, reports by people, I don't know, that it was the CIA that sicked the FBI on Petraeus to bring him down because they hated his guts. Like, they're going to salute his sorry ass. Yes, sir, Mr. Director. But anyway, so let's have it, Greenwald. Come on, man. Hurry up and report that thing. You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Do some calls if you want. Number's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And, you know, I think specifically I'd like to hear what you think about this left-right alliance. Come Home America has done a thing today with Ralph Nader. I guess Ralph Nader's written a new book along these lines. Pushing for realignment. Saying let's get the best of the left and the right together against the empire and against, you know, corporate welfare and the worst of the depredations of the U.S. state, the violations of the Bill of Rights, the bailouts. You know, you want to talk about 99%, you got to include everybody except the 1%. In fact, what would be better would be to make it the 99.9% and make it real clear that it's everybody up to and including millionaires versus the billionaires. That's what it should be. There are no free market billionaires, I don't think. Okay, show me one and I guess I'll entertain your argument, but nah, come on. Billionaires are all on welfare. That's how they're able to accumulate that much money. Is they reach right into the treasury, your tax dollars, or go down the street to the Fed and pick up a stack of bills as they come out of the money machine there. That's how they get so rich. That's who it is. It's the state and the billionaires versus all of us, and their top priority is war and destroying our Bill of Rights forever and making really, really bad business decisions and then getting bailed out by us endlessly. And so, hey, how about you put your stupid, freaking, unsolvable abortion issue to the side for just a minute, please? I mean, actually, I think the gays won and we're done arguing about gay rights in America. Thank God that's over. Thank God they won, too. The good guys won on that one. So, but now we can get to, forget the culture war for a minute. And no, I mean that too. You know, Anthony Gregory was pointing out to me that young, born-again, evangelical Christians are, in their majority, support gay marriage. It's their parents and grandparents who are a bunch of stupid old bigots who can't get over it, but who cares about them? Their days are over. Okay, so that's over. So forget abortion and whatever other stupid, you know, I don't know, I guess race has a lot to do with it, but gender and all that crap, but just try hard, please, everyone, to put aside your cultural differences for a moment in order that we may unite to do our best to force the state to end the empire to end the war on our Bill of Rights, to end welfare for politically connected corporations. If we can all just agree, which who could argue with that unless you're a banker or an arms manufacturer or a general or a congressman? But if you're not part of the 0.1%, then I'm talking to you. Let's all agree of what the government must be stopped from doing before we get to using it to beat each other over the head endlessly about what it ought to be doing to everybody else. Let's come to some real consensus about what we've got to knock off. And of course, the drug war and the entire, you know, criminal justice system would be another huge part of this. It is not okay that we've got way more people in prison than Russia or China. Okay, that's not okay. That has to end tomorrow. That has to end yesterday. Same thing with the endless interventions overseas. Same thing with the bailouts for the billionaires. Even a lot of liberals, very anti-corporate liberals, they're so stuck in the statist economics that they even bought, even the Occupy people in downtown New York, some of them said, well, you know, you had to bail out the banks, you know, but all we're saying is you shouldn't get such a bonus or whatever. Because they believe that that's true, that a world without Citigroup is a world not worth living in. But I'm sorry, part of bankruptcy is other people get to buy up the actual assets that are worth something. But the people who were in charge don't get to be in charge and make the money no more. You guys have a problem with that? For Christ's sake. Well, John McCain said the economy would crater if they didn't bail him out. Well, that's funny because the economy cratered anyway, but they got bailed out. Come on. So there you go. Realignment. And it's easy to just take it a couple of steps further. What if I get my way and Ralph Nader gets his way, and we move toward a more anti-government future? What the hell was I going to say there? Something funny. If we just take a few more steps, then what are we looking at? What are we trying to build here? What's the point? Right? Again, back to the 99% thing. How about this? How about we create a two-party system in America? You know, instead of having the Republicans and the Democrats, we'll have the Democratic Republicans versus the War Party. And the Democratic Republicans can be the party of the American people, and the War Party of death and pain and torture and lies and inflation and bailouts for billionaires and mass murder overseas, well, they'll just have to be called what they are. And no longer will the conservative Democrats and the liberal Republicans get to claim the moderate center. They are the extremists. They are the radicals. They are the authoritarians. They are destroying the American Bill of Rights and everything good about the American system, and they're building a totalitarian state here as they mass murder people without cause and without end overseas. And so then, there you go. You can have your, we'll have Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush run together as the leaders of the War Party. And then we'll get, I don't know, Rand Paul or whoever, the best conservative we can get to run with the very best liberal we can get to oppose them. It should have been, you know, back in 2012, back in 2008, it really should have been Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich running and insisting that Obama and McCain run together, since they were so much alike, agreed on every issue. Except McCain's personality is so out of whack that wouldn't have really, it wouldn't have worked as well. In 2012, it certainly would have worked a lot better that Obama and Romney would run together, kick Biden off the ticket, put Romney on the Obama ticket, since they are exactly in alignment on every single issue in America, up to that point, even including gay marriage. And then it could have been Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich to represent the American people. You know, peace and freedom. The Democratic Republicans, that was Thomas Jefferson's first party, created in opposition to the Hamiltonian, John Adamsian Federalists. They were the Democratic Republicans. And so, there you go. We'll be the Jeffersonians. We'll be the more or less Jeffersonians. And yes, there's still a lot to fight about, unions or not, and whatever, what's to be done with the future of Medicaid and all these things. And I'd be happy to watch all you people tear each other's eyes out over that crap. But you gotta stop the empire before it gets us all killed. And you gotta save the rights before there's no such thing anymore. I mean, really, they passed a law. They got away with passing and signing a law for years now that says that they can hold any of us in military detention without trial. And now they have not put that into widespread effect yet. They may very well have already put it into effect in some places. We don't know. In fact, the court, the judge that initially ruled in favor of the plaintiffs on the NDAA case said, or was furnished with information by the Ellsberg Hedges lawyers, that there is reason to believe that Americans arrested overseas are being held this way right now, given the Padilla treatment. Obama legalized it. I mean, I don't know how else to say that this is a truly national emergency, that our government, in the name of a national emergency, can claim the power to do this to us. It has to be stopped before it gets really put into effect in a major way. And that's just, of course, one of a thousand points to bring up. But if that ain't the fire bell in the night warning you about the death of the Republic, I just don't know what to tell you. The death of what was left of it, what the empire had left.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, all Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Now, the thing of it is that Phil Giraldi is going to be here in just a few minutes. So you have to hang tight and listen to me. In fact, no, you don't. You could call in and say what you want to say. Ask me a question. Comment on the realignment especially, but on whatever else you want. We've covered a lot of ground today. India, Pakistan, and the Afghan war, and all this kind of madness. There's always Greenwald and Snowden in the news. Whatever you think about, whatever you want. This is your chance to have a little bit of a radio show, so come on in. Call on in if you want. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And I'll just mention very briefly that there are two ridiculous attacks on Glenn Greenwald and on journalism, one by Michael Kinsley and another by George Packer. And if you read Just Raimondo's takedown of George Packer, it's absolutely hilarious. And so I recommend that you do that at antiwar.com/Justin. And then there's this really great piece that came out today at salon.com challenging them and taking Snowden and Greenwald's side here. And the thing of it is that, well, it's really good. So go and read it. And it's called, hell, I don't have it in front of me anymore. Where'd it go? Greenwald something? Ah, crap. Anyway, it's at salon.com. If you could stand going to salon.com for any reason, this would be one. And, well, I got it here. I wanted to interview the guy. Here it is. The Empire Strikes Back. How Brandeis foreshadowed Snowden and Greenwald. And so this is a good liberal sticking up for Greenwald and Snowden against a bad liberal attack on them and the professional of journalism and vocabulary. Anyway, so go look at that. And then also, I wanted to mention the Oklahoma bombing. I hardly ever talk about this anymore. Hell, it used to be almost the only reason I did radio was to tell you about the Oklahoma bombing all the time. Because I believed sort of magically that if
somehow the American people could just come to understand that, yeah, actually a bunch of people helped McVeigh do that, and they were all flip states witnesses and government informants and at the time, and maybe perhaps including agent provocateurs sent in just to, in fact, accomplish such an atrocity, and that the entire government and the entire media closed ranks in order to blame one guy and exclude even the possibility of guilt of anyone else, etc., that then that would make everyone hate them, hate the government, hate the media. How could it possibly be that they could lie about the worst thing that ever happened? This is before September 11th. That Oklahoma bombing was no joke. 186 people killed, an entire daycare full of babies and little toddlers slaughtered. And they came out with a straight face and they said, now listen, there was no John Doe 2. And any and all witnesses who ever saw McVeigh with any other person is a liar or was confused or is stupid or you just don't need to think about that anymore. And they got away with that. And it was a lie. And it's come up again in this piece because this is the Brandeis piece where Justice Brandeis writes in a dissent on a unreasonable search case way back when, I forget how many decades ago, that government is, and this is amazing that it's true, but I admit that it is true in this society, even if it doesn't apply to me, and that is that government is the great moral teacher. It is the definition. Those are the guys who hold everyone else accountable for their moral failings and infringements on other people. Right, they're the ones who we give the right to infringe on the rights of others just so they can do the rest of the infringing and claim a monopoly on it and do it according to the institution and the law and the etc. And what Brandeis said was if the government is lawless, then the people will be lawless. And then we will all regret it. And so then he talks about how Timothy McVeigh, which he's kind of making a very kind of vague and, but well, it's a very particular but not very well-defined, I think, distinction, you know, or connection between McVeigh and Snowden here. Not that he's calling Snowden a terrorist, but just what motivates these people to do what they do, et cetera, like that. And so the status is then in a bad position for criticizing what Snowden is doing in a way, since they're the ones who basically set the standard. And then he quotes McVeigh from his execution, quoted this same Brandeis quote, and how he had learned this reading this article by Gore Vidal. Oh, I know I'm going far afield, but if you read Gore Vidal, you'll find out that Timothy McVeigh, as this guy puts it, far from being just some, you know, straw-eaten right-wing redneck idiot, mass murder, guilty as hell. Nobody's saying not guilty as hell, but just that there was more to him than that, that he wasn't a cartoon character. And that, for example, he had written back and forth at length with Gore Vidal. And Gore Vidal had written an article that came out actually September 2001 that nobody paid attention to, all about it and all about the Oklahoma bombing case, and begins to get into the question of whether anyone else helped him toward the end of the article. And it's a big, important article. So, to try to sum up here, guy at Salon.com writes an article defending Greenwald and Snowden. In it, he brings up this quote from Brandeis that McVeigh brought up, that Gore Vidal brought up. So now this has all of Salon.com a Twitter. Andrew O'Heher here, who I tried to invite on the show, but I didn't hear back from him. Maybe we'll be able to get him on later in the week. But he and Greenwald and Joan Walsh over there at Salon, these, you know, Salon there, and he used to write there, Greenwald did, they're center left, you know, they call themselves progressives, but they're not too outside the Democratic Party in their point of view for the most part. I'm not saying they're as, well, they're clearly not as default pro-state as some. But anyway, so they brought up, yeah, it's kind of weird the way Gore Vidal starts getting into this conspiracy stuff on Twitter. And so I tweeted that actually, well, here is Peter Bergen, who is the most respected by liberals anyway, terrorist expert in America, bar none. This guy interviewed Osama bin Laden for real and wrote all about them and is a real ass expert. And he's a bit of a Democratic partisan himself. And for those not familiar, Oklahoma bombing, that's 1995, Bill Clinton cover-up, etc. And Bergen yet goes ahead and has hosted, and you can tell that he read the book and he knows what's going on here, and he's not some idiot, and he knows what's right, and he interviews and promotes a guy named Andrew Gumbel, who wrote a book called The Oklahoma City Bombing, What Was Missed and Why It Matters. And he co-wrote it with Roger Charles, friend of the show, and more importantly, friend of J.D. Cash and former ABC World News Tonight producer and 2020 producer, who co-wrote the book with him. And it's a very mild treatment of the story, because I think, just like me, my hope since 1995, my fervent prayer since 1995, that if only the people knew just how bad of a distortion of a truth that they can get away with about something so important, that then they'll snap out of it. They'll wake up to it. They'll want to not be bribed by these people who could be so bad and so wrong and cover up so much and have so much prior knowledge and fail so horribly to protect the lives of their own, I mean, literally their own people, their federal government employees in that building. And I'm talking about the FBI under the authority of Bob Ricks, the chief of the Tulsa office, and others. And they know who they are. But so I tweeted Bergen, and then I tweeted James Ridgway and Mother Jones too. And I said, look, guys, these are center-left, respectable by you sources. Read them. Check it out. It's real. No response. They just don't want to touch it. Even Glenn. Makes me sad. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And next up is Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer, and now writer at Al Jazeera and UNS.com, as well as the American Conservative Magazine. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And it's a hell of an article you have here, Baiting Dragons, Bears, and Lions at the UNS Review. Again, that's UNS.com, U-N-Z, UNS.com. And this is about the American Empire. I think, as you put it, they got no, well, I don't know exactly how you put it. Something about they have no real cards to play, and the fewer cards to play that they have, the more of a fight they seem to want to pick with people who can apparently just ignore us without consequence and go on about their business. So first up here, and or, you know, could lead to a crisis, but not one where America seems to have any obvious way of getting what they want. So first of all, could you take us through all the different contrapes with China here, the rising yellow peril in the East?
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, we've come down heavily on the side of one communist government against the other communist government, siding with Vietnam against China. China admittedly triggered a series of incidents by placing a oil drilling rig in disputed territory in the South China Sea, area that was disputed with Vietnam. And Vietnam reacted by, or rather the Vietnamese people reacted by rioting and killing a number of Chinese who were running factories and businesses in Vietnam. And anyway, Obama immediately jumped into it and said that the Chinese had staged a disgraceful provocation. And as a result, the United States condemned the action. Now, my point is that, you know, what goes on between China and Vietnam is in a lot of ways none of our business. And secondly, the statement by Obama absolutely has no teeth of any kind, because both countries are acting in terms of their own self-interests. We have nothing to do with it. And the fact that our government and our president would feel compelled to make a comment in a situation in which he has no influence whatsoever, to me, is the height of hypocrisy and actually stupidity.
Yeah, it makes him look even weaker, really. It seems kind of ham-handed. Oh, look, something to say. I better get out there and say something, kind of a thing, when you know, this would be a great opportunity for him to actually sit back and not say something for once, maybe.
Yeah, that's right. He's going to make a speech, I guess, tomorrow night about at West Point about his foreign policy. It should be fun to watch. The other point I make is about the naming of five Chinese military officers in an indictment in the United States for cybersecurity issues. And of course, is there a bigger hacker in the world than the United States government? Here it's accusing the Chinese of doing the same thing, although on a much smaller scale. It's just, again, is it going to change anything? No, it's not going to change anything. It's just it's another kind of empty threat, a commentary, as I think you put it, in terms of, you know, how weak we look, how silly we look. And I think everybody's going to see it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, what, 4 or 5 days later, somebody at the State Department said, well, you know, yeah, those indictments were basically symbolic. Symbolic? What, that they're copying DVDs of U.S. movies? Is that it? Is that what we're crying about here? Or what is it that they supposedly did?
Yeah, well, basically the accusation was that China has a part of its military that hacks into primarily industrial websites in other countries to obtain technological secrets that make them more competitive in terms of their own business and that sort of thing. So that should surprise no one that that's going on.
How do they figure indict foreign government officials for something like that, though? I guess sovereign immunity only applies to American government officials.
Yeah, I think that's clearly the way they see it.
It just seems like a very strange way to handle it, right? Indictments of individuals.
Well, you know, I read a lot of the commentary on this, and there were a lot of people saying a lot of goofy things about what this was intended to do. But I can't make any sense out of it. I mean, if there was somebody in the National Security Council or the White House who had a sensible agenda here, I can't even fathom what it might be.
Yeah, even with a bad motive. I mean, again, another exercise in just looking like goofballs here. As the empire's falling apart, I mean, it could be worse. It could be lashing out much more violent ways, I guess. But it seems like they could be leaving well enough alone here rather than, you know, getting too excited all the time.
Sure, and as the rest of the article goes on, I assume we'll talk about it. I'm talking, you know, you see the same kind of pattern of inconsequential behavior playing out in terms of how we're dealing with Russia and in terms of how we're dealing with Iran.
Right, yeah, again, lots of talking big but not carrying much of a big stick, right?
Well, it's not only that. It's just, you know, if the idea is that you're going to be saying something that will have a result, then I can't see where the saying something in all these cases has had any result at all, except to make people think that the United States has finally completely gone Looney Tunes.
Right. All right. Well, now, so we talked a bit about Ukraine with Ray McGovern on the show earlier, your fellow veteran intelligence professional for Sanity there. So I guess one of the things that Ray kept talking about was about NATO expansion over these years since the end of the Cold War. And I'm trying to remember where it was I read, but I guess it doesn't really matter, that many Americans actually don't know what NATO is. I think they're probably all familiar with the term, but they don't really understand the nature of the military alliance or what exactly NATO expansion means or which direction on the map it's going or why anyone cares. It becomes a bit esoteric. It sounds like the kind of thing that, well, certainly more people should be aware of, but apparently are really lacking it. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about that and, you know, how America is taking on Russia, making, you know, a much more of an adversary out of Russia than is necessary here, and what they're supposed to get out of it, if anything.
Well, NATO was created in the wake of the Second World War, and the original intention, or the original argument, was basically that communism, and at that time, of course, we had Joseph Stalin as the communist, was in an expansionistic mood, It was basically, it had basically taken half of Germany. It was occupying Austria. There were strong communist parties in France, Italy, Spain. Communism seemed to be on the march. So the argument was that the United States wanted to create a military alliance in Western Europe that basically counter any kind of overt attempt by the Soviet Union and by communism to take a bigger bite out of Europe. So that was the original idea. The problem was, of course, that there's never been actually any kind of war with the communist bloc that formed its own Warsaw Pact as a response. So this basically created the Cold War, which lasted for 50 years. And anyway, the alliances had no meaning since that time, because by 1992, the Soviet Union, or Russia, as it then became again, no longer was an expansionist power, no longer was aggressive, was in fact showing every sign of being willing to become part of a broader economic and political community. So the whole argument for the continuation of NATO basically fell apart. But the problem is NATO did continue, and it had a nice bureaucracy in Brussels. It had a lot of member states who were benefiting in one way or another in budgetary terms and other ways by the money coming in. So it continued to survive, and now we see the strange spectacle of NATO, which was created to defend Western Europe, essentially, getting involved in places like Libya, getting involved in Afghanistan, getting involved hypothetically in Syria. And now, of course, the alliance has been expanding and expanding and expanding, even though the Cold War is long since over. And
all right, well, we got to hold it right there, sir. It's Phil Giraldi, everybody. We're going out to this break. We'll be right back after this. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for hanging on through that break. We're talking with Phil Giraldi from the American conservative magazine, UNS.com, and writing for Al Jazeera now sometimes, too, which is great. And now this one is at UNS.com, Baiting Dragons, Bears, and Lions. And so we're talking about NATO expansion up to Russia's border there, and now I learned in this article, why did I not know this, that they the anti-missile missiles going into Poland that had been called off have been called back on again? Is that right, Phil?
Yeah, that's right. The Obama administration basically reversed itself on the issue. I don't know under what kind of pressure, but the fact is that, you know, this is kind of an on again, off again project. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that if it goes the other way yet again, because it's one of these things that's completely senseless. The whole project is being billed as a defense against Iran, but in fact the Russians have known that that really has nothing to do with it, because Iran doesn't pose any ballistic missile threat, whereas in theory the Russians do.
Yeah, and in what circumstance would Iran end up? I guess if there was a NATO war against Iran, then they could conceivably strike at Poland, that it, you know, in some future when they got their missiles that can actually reach that far, but not with nukes because they don't have any of those. But anyway, is this? I remember at the time when the Bush administration began pushing this, and Bush claimed it was about Iran, everybody laughed. I mean, Putin couldn't even help it. It was sort of just one of those, oh my God, are you kidding me, kind of things live on TV. And then, but also, I think on you know, the TV news channels here in America, nobody took it seriously that this is about protecting Poland from Iran. This is all about, you know, something on the order of trying to create that real first strike capability against Russia, be able to shoot down anything that they could use as their retaliatory nuclear strike if we wanted to pick a war with them, a real one.
Yeah, that's the scary thing about all this. The only way the whole thing makes sense is that if you have some kind of, you know, what Reagan used to call your strategic defense initiative to be able to shoot down the enemy missiles or to block them, the only reason you would want to have that is so that you have a superiority. And the Russians understand this real well. There's only one adversary to the United States in the world in a real sense, in a military sense, and that's Russia. So they understand it, and again, this is a silly bit of policy that only makes any kind of collaboration with Russia on the world stage more difficult. And, you know, it's mind-boggling to watch this.
Well, you know, for years we've talked about just how mind-boggling it is that these people are as hell-bent as they are and have been about regime change in Iran, because how the hell are you supposed to do it? There's no way you're going to get away with a CIA 53 again type coup d'etat. They know better than that. They've learned that lesson. You know, look at 09. They didn't even, and I don't think that was so much an American op as just an example of the regime being willing to stay in power in the face of some protests like that. And you can't just bomb them and get a regime change from the air. You can't send in the 3rd Infantry Division to sack Tehran, not without, you know, a gigantic invasion of Europe and World War II style thing. So it's always been off the table. But I don't know if I've ever really asked you, Phil, if, you know, the context of this plan, what seems like really a long-term plan anyway, even if it lacks specifics, for regime change in Russia. Do they really think that they can outsmart the FSB and somehow replace Putin with another Yeltsin after all this?
Yeah, I think they do, actually. I think if you read the neocon media, I'm sure you look at it as I do, you will see that they have some really crazy ideas. The whole idea about you know, regime change in Iran is that they have this weird idea that the Greens or the counter-revolutionaries are someday going to rise up and change the government there. So they encourage that. And they also have this crazy idea that if they push hard enough, the Russians will turn on Putin and they'll allegedly, I guess, elect some social democrat of some kind who loves the United States. I mean, it's just I don't know where they come up with this stuff. I mean, these people are not smart enough as nationalists to understand that in all these countries, the things that push their buttons are a lot different than what push buttons here in the United States, and they never quite get that.
Right. Well, and the Russians, I don't know everything about them, but I think that's sort of the point, too. You don't have to know much about the Russians to know that patriotism and nationalism mean a lot to them. And this is, you know, always neglected in all the stories of the Second World War as told in the United States. They lost 20 million plus people to the German invasion. So they take World War II a little bit more seriously, even the Americans, who invoke it as their excuse to do anything and everywhere. So this is a fiercely nationalistic society for a reason. They've been made that way by endless invasions over the centuries.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, in Russia, the Russian word for their country is the Rodina, which means the motherland. And they have a very strong identification with soil and nationality and ethnicity. And the fact is, you know, all right, we don't have that, but somehow they and I might add that Vladimir Putin is extremely popular, and yet we have these kind of warped ideas of what Victoria Nuland passing out cookies will accomplish.
Right. Well, and yeah, Ray was, as I mentioned on the show earlier, and he quoted that part of Putin's speech where he says, you know, we love the NATO sailors. Those guys are great guys, but, you know, we just can't imagine visiting them down at our former Navy base there in Crimea. So we're going to go ahead and make sure and keep our base now. And, you know, pretty honest and above board there. You know, maybe not the most moral activity of any national leader ever, but certainly understandable from an international politics point of view, what happened there.
Well, you know, Putin has a real clarity about what he says and how he says it, because he actually understands the issues and he believes in what he's saying. I mean, I hate to say this, but
No wonder no one in D.C. understands him, right?
Yeah, exactly. I talk to a lot of people on a weekly basis, and they all say, gee, I wish we had the equivalent to Putin in this country, somebody that you could vote for, that you actually could understand what they're saying and believe that when they're saying it because they believe it.
Right.
You know, we don't have that.
Yeah, I mean, he may be a gangster, but at least you know exactly whose side he's on and all of that.
That's exactly right. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, my pop's a Democrat, but he said he always respected Barry Goldwater. Disagree with him on every single thing, but always respected Goldwater because at least you knew that he meant what he said. He is never lying, ever. And so you could at least take to a bank that he was doing what he was doing for the reasons that he said he was doing it, et cetera, like that. He was a known quantity and somebody you can deal with kind of thing. And, yeah, that's something that is clearly lacking since Ron Paul left the House. He was the last one, if you ask me. I think I've read some things saying you feel the same way.
Assessment.
Yeah.
Yep.
Too bad. All right. Well, so now when it comes to NGOs and Pussy Riot and this, that, the other thing, I mean, how far can they push that game inside? And Putin's already kind of banned international NGOs and all of that. But, I mean, how effective were they ever, you know, in the first place? Were they ever really a threat at all?
I think they're like everything else that the United States gets involved in. They're a money turning over machine, yeah. And a lot of these organizations basically exist because they exist to take money that comes out of the pockets of the taxpayer and put it in the pockets of the bureaucrats who run these organizations, and they don't really accomplish anything. Some years ago I did a study of what our interference in Cambodia with the National Endowment for Democracy, and it seemed to me that it was very clear that they weren't doing anything but wasting money, and I suspect that's what they do everywhere. They encourage people to oppose their own governments, which produces inevitably bad results, and it makes the governments, you know, want to get rid of them, and basically they don't ever accomplish anything. If you call the pastel revolutions in Eastern Europe successes, I think you're delusional.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, every single one of them faded to black, as Justin Raimondo put it, within a couple of years there. By 05 or 06, it was over.
That's
Cedar
right.
Cedar Revolution and all of this. Give me a break. All right, so now, last part of the essay here, and extremely important and really bumming me out, is the issue of Iranian ballistic missiles being brought up in the nuclear talks. And I wonder whether you agree with Gareth Porter that Obama's blowing up his own negotiation here. It's just 05 all over again.
Yeah, that's what I suspect is happening here, that I think Obama is under considerable pressure from the usual suspects to make these negotiations go away. Hillary Clinton, of course, has even chimed in recently. And basically, this ballistic missile issue was not in the original brief for what they were going to be talking about, and it's been introduced by the United States. The only reason to introduce it would be basically to make these talks fail. And that's a tragedy because Iran wants to come to a deal. Virtually everybody else wants to come to a deal.
Right. Tragedy. That's what I was going to say. Thanks, Phil.
Okay, Scott.